From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host, and I'm really glad you guys can join us this afternoon. Our program today is going to be a topic we have not covered in 13 years on the air. I'm kind of surprised at that myself. If you'd like to listen to the longer version of our program, we've changed the website location here at KUAR. We're now part of the NPR web organization. So if you go to KUAR.org and you click on Programs, you'll have to just scroll down to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, and you'll see our recent programs posted there. And then off to the side on that page is where our podcasts are now located. This has been a little bit of a difficult program, I guess, because of the word that we're using. The topic today is hippies. I come from that problem in the sense that people I asked to be on the program had to necessarily self-identify in some way or another with being a hippie, and that was one of the things I found difficult as I went through the younger section. I put together the program here today with three guests. Our older generation guest joining us from Mountain View, Arkansas, is Tom Cloud. He and his wife own For Mother Earth and in Mountain View. It's a store that is usually called the Hippie Shop there by the locals. It's right down there on the main street, a store dealing with, if I'm right, Tom, you can correct me here, almost exclusively hemp products. Is that right?
We have a lot of hemp and earth-friendly products. We certainly do. We carry a wide variety of things that kind of cover the hippie spectrum. We're not a smoke shop, but we're an earth-friendly shop.
And then joining us from Colorado today is Rob Savoye. He is the, in quotations here, he is the self-appointed maintainer of the unofficial Rainbow Family website. And he can tell you a little bit about why we put that in quotation. And he's been deeply involved in the gathering infrastructure and other processes for several decades. Rob Savoye, glad to have you with us here today.
Howdy.
And let me give you a chance to mention that, why you put the quotations around self-appointed.
Just to make sure nobody forgot it, since nobody can represent the Rainbow Family, I can't be appointed, nor did anybody ever ask me to do my website, so I'm only in charge of myself. There's been issues about that kind of thing in the past, so I just always find it's really good to be clear. There is nobody in charge in Rainbow. We just all like to do things.
And apparently no official members either, right?
The joke on my website is we're the largest non-organization of non-members on the planet.
Right. And then joining us from Fayetteville, Arkansas, is Emma Yingling. She's from Winslow, Arkansas, actually, and she's on the steering committee and serves as the secretary for the medical marijuana campaign here in Arkansas, the Arkansans for Compassionate Care. Emma, glad to have you with us. Okay, I want to begin the discussion here really with what I started out with, the self-identifying portion of it. And let me first start with you, Tom Cloud, on that as one of our older member generations. To call yourself a hippie, was that an easy thing to do when you were younger? Was it a natural thing?
Well, actually, certainly it was for me. As soon as I learned about the culture, as soon as I started seeing the photographs of the people involved and hearing the themes behind it, I embraced that name. But I really think that it was rather like the term Chicano. It was started out as a slightly insulting term that the people took and wore proudly and carried forward and made into their own culture and own identification.
Is that an identifying term that you've kept throughout your life then?
Yeah, for me it has been. I'm proud to be a hippie.
Rob Savoye, let me ask you basically the same question. Is that an identifying term that you have found the people you've dealt with, that they actually take that as a self-identifying term?
Well, you know, hippie is just a label, right? It's what other people have to call us. We're just doing what we want to do. And that's the label that people seem to use because it seems like it's representative. Oh, he's got long hair. He must be a hippie. You know, I was a raging deadhead. That's even a smaller subculture. But yeah, I would guess I would consider myself a hippie in the sort of slightly generic definition, but it's a pretty wide definition, so it's really hard to say. And some people have a pretty negative definition. I have a pretty positive one of the whole hippie thing.
Rob, let me stay with you. As you look across the gatherings that come through Rainbow, when you look at the age groups that come through there, are there any things that you would say really do give an iconic term to describe them as hippies, or has something changed in that over the years?
I think it's changed? I mean, like you were saying earlier, you know, the joke used to be you saw some guy with long hair and a tie-dye T-shirt. Oh, he must be a hippie. Kids, I think these days, they're not so into all of those particular types of trappings, although you do see that. I mean, I live near Boulder, Colorado. But I think, as I said, I mean, hippie is what you do. It's not necessarily what you look like. Mm-hmm. I know raging hippies with short hair and no beards, and yeah, it's hard to say, but the kids have their own sense of style.
Tom, people coming in your shop up there, a lot of them are tourists. Do you see anything that identifies them automatically to your eye as a hippie?
Certainly, there are some visual clues. Usually, you know, as Rob said, long hair is a key, dreadlocks, tattoos, and really just a certain attitude, a certain embracing of what they see in our shop, and when they see me, who also has long hairs and tattoos and that sort of thing. There's a kinship there.
Yep, the attitude is really what makes the difference more than the appearance.
Well, that takes me to that question there, Rob. Let me let you expand on that. What is that attitude that kind of gone across the generations that explains a hippie?
I'll try and pick an example from some of the younger folks that I've bumped into at Rainbow Gatherings the last couple of years, and I'm talking about the sort of 20-somethings. And, you know, whether the definition of the stereotypical definition hippie applies to that is kind of hard to say. But these kids are there really strong for community, you know, really, really strong for, you know, the planet. They've got a really good sense of spirituality and stuff, kind of looking out for other people on the planet and trying to live lightly with minimal impact and do good deeds. And that's kind of one of the things that's really, I think, survived across all the generations.
Tom, does that sound similar to where you were when you were very young? Was that the same sort of philosophy that gathered you into the group?
Oh, absolutely. And when I was younger, that was a rather radical philosophy. We were living in the better living through chemistry days with the hope of nuclear power. And you really were supposed to fit a particular mold. You were born into a particular pattern, and you found a wife, you got a good job, you blah, blah, blah. And hippies tended to reject that and right away did embrace the earth and earlier cultures and other cultures and your right to look and dress and appear as you choose to and be based on your interactions with other people as opposed to how you looked or what your job was or what your race was.
The question I had in my mind coming into this is what really is so counter about the hippie movement, calling it a counterculture. Why did you call or why did you think that you guys were in a counterculture when you were young, and has that changed for you as you've gotten older?
Absolutely. We considered ourselves counter, I think, because we were trying to break that mold that came with the Eisenhower years of men looked a certain way and dressed a certain way, women looked a certain way and dressed a certain way. They had certain types of relationships, and the counterculture just balked at that, and all of a sudden, you could dress the way you wanted to. You could have a beard, not have a beard, be in any type of sexual relationship that you wanted. And I think that aspect really hasn't changed over the years. I think that the hippie movement embraced a lot of the other countercultural movements, such as the gay rights movement, the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, and all of it just kind of moved under an umbrella that we call a counterculture that was a rebellion against that mold that we felt we were born into.
Well, Rob Savoyer, did you come across with the same countercultural classifications as you were going through your life?
Yeah, but probably more for what I do for a living than anything else. You know, I guess I never really thought of us as counter to society. I just saw us following our own path. Other people thought we were counter to something. We were just trying to live a slightly better lifestyle. It wasn't really counter to anything, even if we did have a tendency to, you know, not trust the government and try and live under the radar and a lot of that kinds of stuff. But, of course, these days, a lot of the, quote, hippie beliefs of, you know, several generations ago have been pretty much adopted by mainstream, sort of the mainstream normal people. I mean, Amendment 64 here in Colorado, who would have ever thought of such a thing?
Well, you said the word a few minutes ago, live a better life. What does that mean to people in the hippie movement, as you've seen across time?
You know, I look at it as little things. Like, this is going to sound like stereotypical, but a lot of the hippies that I know, they're really into their children if they become parents because they want to have a better connection with their kids. Most of us, when we were growing up, Dad worked overtime. He came home at night, and he sat in his chair. You didn't bother him, and he drank a cup of wine, and he went to bed, you know? And it was like dads did that, and moms did their own thing. And I think a lot of the things is a lot of, quote, hippie parents are so much more involved in their family, their community, their extended friend connections. It's a lot more kind of social than how I remember growing up, you know. And I think that kind of goes along with trying to live lightly on the earth and having respect for living creatures of all kinds. But a lot of us, I think, have tried to connect more with our kids than our parents did.
Well, are there some stereotypes that are correct or incorrect that you guys would talk about that fit into the hippie classification? Tom Cloud, let's come back to you with that. What are the stereotypes that are right and the stereotypes that are wrong?
Well, some of the stereotypes that I see particularly the media to present is the Tommy Chong persona, which is a parody, but it's presented as what we all are, so stoned that we really can't function, and so brain dead that we're pretty much unaware of what's going on around us. There's, of course, the hippies don't like to bathe, hippies are dirty, and that sort of thing. And I think that has changed a lot. I think the hippies led the way in the natural foods movement. They led the way in the back to the earth movement. They led the way in the vegetarian movement and being free of chemicals and pesticides, even though our culture embraced chemicals in the consciousness term in the early part of it. Very early on, we started rejecting that, and we learned that that wasn't good for our bodies, and we extended that outward to the other things that society offers us, the chemicals that are in our food and our body care products and whatnot, and we certainly have led the way in rejecting that, and now that's become quite mainstream. Health food stores are common now, or in the early days, we're funny little hippie shops that the mainstream laughed at, and it goes on and on in the culture. Tie-dyes are certainly an everyday thing now. Mom and pop wear tie-dyes, and back in the early days, it was quite revolutionary.
Rob Savoy, from your perspective, what's correct about the stereotypes, and what's incorrect?
Well, you know, I hate to say there's more stuff that's incorrect than correct. I mean, like Tom was just saying, I mean, the stereotypical public perception was that hippies were unbathed and they didn't clean their hair and they, you know, slept with their dog and, you know, were always living out of dumpsters and shoplifting all the time and stuff like that. And most of the stereotype things were pretty negative, to the best of my memory. It still kind of is, depending where you are in the country.
You lead me to that question, is have we gotten over the hump of that stereotyping of people who classify themselves or self-identify as hippies?
In some ways, yeah. I guess a classic example I think of is, you know, you guys remember Katrina, right? It basically did a huge damage. Well,
yes.
A lot of us from the Rainbow family went down to Katrina and built a relief camp in southern Mississippi and Missouri and New Orleans and stuff. And this is probably not what I would have really called a hippie-friendly part of the world. But when they saw how everybody was helping people and feeding people and renovating and cleaning up, and we built medical clinics and stuff, a lot of people there saw the actual positive aspects of the sort of hippie movement and was like, hey, this terrible thing just happened, and we're going to go down and try and do our best to make it better. And a lot of that attitude we got in the beginning was really strange. They called us Hippieville in our little relief camp. They quickly kind of got quite used to us and actually didn't want us to leave when we were done.
Well, And let me let you expand just a tad on that, because here in Arkansas, we felt a lot of the overflow of people who were forced out of Louisiana from that time frame. And I know that from what I understand about the Rainbow group that was down there, you guys did an extraordinary job beyond what many governmental organizations could do to help people.
Well, we built what turned into the largest relief camp for all of Katrina. We literally had 5,000 people living in tents in the woods right next to us, even though we were living in a discount store department parking lot at the time and stuff. We built the only functioning field hospital down there, and we were the primary medical care and food source and clothing for people that had lost everything for several months. And a lot of the FEMA and the Red Cross people stayed way out of town. We lived in the middle of it all, so we were accessible to people. And eventually, we got, I mean, even the Red Cross and FEMA, they'd come and they'd eat with us and party with us and hang out and stuff. And they kind of realized that, bizarrely, our sort of orientation of nobody being in charge is a great way to deal with a disaster. Because all the organized groups fell apart in the disaster. They couldn't function. Hierarchy was bad. No cell phones worked. No communication. We just did our thing. We were feeding, at a point, over 3,000 people every meal, three times a day, cooked from scratch, whatever was donated.
I understand that that was a very successful operation during that time frame, but hasn't the same thing happened in other disaster areas around the country? Were you guys out east, too, during the snow deal?
Yeah, we actually had a bunch of people from there set up for this blizzard. We had a big kitchen running out of a fire station for Sandy. Crews of us actually went to Hurricanes Rita and Hurricanes Ike and a bunch of the other ones you hear about. We actually tried to go to Haiti when they got hit, but that turned out to be kind of a military-type operation, and that was not really a safe place for people to be. But yeah, we've realized that our ability to kind of coordinate as opposed to be organized is a real big, powerful thing, especially when dealing with a disaster.
Rob Savoy, the people that were involved in all those efforts that you're talking about, would they be classified as hippies?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you want to go by the stereotypical thing, of course. A lot of the people there had long hair. Quite a few had dreadlocks. Many people wore tie-dye or handmade clothing or any of the other kinds of things that people would associate with how hippies look. At the same time, everybody worked 20-hour shifts and busted their ass. It was pretty cool. It was a pretty amazing experience, to be honest. It was nice to have a visible improvement in the local community and really help a lot of people out in a way that the government couldn't. The government was somewhat powerless down there. It was kind of amazing.
Emmy Yingling and the younger generation, let me ask you about the stereotypes that you have as a young person. Are you carrying on any of the stereotypes, good and bad, from the word hippie? Do younger people have those stereotypes that are negative still attached to them?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I would say more often than not, it's a negative stereotype because people are misnamed hippies, such as the Occupy Wall Street movement. I heard of so many people my age calling those people hippies, which I wouldn't have referred to them as that. Many of the people that supported that and went to Wall Street who were, I don't know how to label them, but I wouldn't have labeled them hippies, and that's how a lot of my generation saw them, which I thought was bizarre.
As I introduced the program, I mentioned that one of my hardest parts of getting this program organized was to find some young people who self-identified as hippie. People your age, does the word hippie, is that a word you want to use to describe yourselves?
That's how I would describe myself. I think it depends. There's this negative connotation with it. If you go to a music festival or you see anyone with dreadlocks, people want to associate those actions or those things with hippie. But to me, a hippie means someone who desires to live off the land, make as little of an impact on the environment as possible, has a healthy diet, is aware of the meats, the dairy, all these things that they're eating, and also has a peaceful, loving nature.
Well, that part, listen to all three of you talk, sounds like it has stayed the same. Tom Cloud, is that when you listen to Emma talking about the younger generation, does it ring true to you for when you were young?
Oh, absolutely. There's a direct line, and peace is one of the operative terms. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about peace within ourselves, peace within our communities, our families, our countries, and about the world. It isn't just a lack of war, which certainly is the ultimate unpeaceful act, but in all manner of ways, throwing trash in the stream is a not peaceful act, and peaceful or respectful of the earth. And I think hippies of all generations try their best to embrace the concept of kindness and peace and gentleness in our interaction with each other and with our world.
Well, one of the things that has crossed my mind as I was thinking about the program and developing the ideas for the program was the word uniform. And Rob Savoy, you kind of talked about that earlier in the program about in the counterculture. And I'm thinking of the Eisenhower days. You're talking about the post-war period of time when men went to work in their tie and their suit, and the women wore the certain dresses around the house all day long. We had these uniforms. And the uniform of the hippie, I guess you would say, is the tie-dye, that maybe the bell-bottom pants or whatever, or the dreadlocks. Is there a connection to what you wear that makes you identify yourself as a hippie, Tom?
I'm not sure that if what I wear makes me identify myself as a hippie. There's a lot of naked hippies, as Rob can tell you at the Rainbow. But certainly we do tend to recognize each other by our outfits, and there is a certain truth to that.
And I think that's exactly right. I think that some people adopted certain things of the style of dress because we wanted to identify ourselves, because some of us were like the only hippie in the whole area. And sometimes you'd see somebody in a tie-dye T-shirt down the street and you'd go, wow, that's my next best friend. So, you know, it was kind of like identifying yourself as part of the loose community and stuff like that. Because for a lot of us, the Rainbow Gatherings, at least in our case, was our family. That was the one that we made, and not so much the one we were born into.
Well, in a business sense, it was a convention. where like-minded people or like people who were involved in a certain thing. And in this case, the Rainbow Gathering brought together a convention of people who were like-minded, correct?
Well, you know, funny enough, it would be hard to say that your average rainbow person is like-minded. The amount of diversity is fascinating, especially when it's all mixed around the same campfire. Everything from, quote, rednecks to cowboys to, quote, hippies to the goths, the punks, the locals, and everybody's, like, hanging out and doing it together. It's pretty amazing. There's probably less uniform of thought you would think of at a gathering, which is kind of what we do. We want to embrace differentness.
I do want to ask all three of you guys to comment on a period of time that seemed to be lacking in hippie involvement or hippie recognition, and that would probably be the 80s, maybe the early 90s too, when it seemed like from what I've looked at our culture anyway, that the hippies kind of disappeared for a little while. Was that while, Tom, your age group got into their middle years and kind of walked away from some of the hippie thoughts and hippie philosophy?
Well, certainly a lot of that did happen, and in my store I constantly have people that say, I used to be a hippie, or just as soon as I retire I'm going to grow my hair and smoke marijuana or whatever. But there was a certain amount of that. The folks went underground because they felt like their livelihoods depended on that. They had to take urine tests. They had to worry about losing their jobs if they were straightforward about who they were, but I don't think it ever disappeared. I think there's always been a large underground. It may not have been broadcast by the media, and it may not have been, you know, broadcast to mom and pop America, but the communes never quit, the gatherings never quit, the street people never quit, the peace walkers and peace pilgrims never quit. It's been going on all along. Sometimes we have more national notice than others, but we're there and we're still here and we'll be here tomorrow.
Well, Rob Savoia, let me ask you about even your involvement with the Rainbow. During that 80s time frame, did you guys see a difference in the hippie quotations to describe what was going on then?
Tom's kind of right. It wasn't so much that people went underground, is that sort of distilled, super-focused hippie lifestyle, so to speak, is actually really hard to maintain for a long time. I mean, if you're in the living on the road, you get tired of waking up in the back of your truck and junk. And people didn't, I think, so much go underground as try and adopt a little bit of, you know, the society around us to keep your income going and, you know, raise your family and stuff. But in a certain sense, we infiltrated mainstream society, and a lot of our beliefs actually got into and have become part of the mainstream society, like green energy and recycling and things like that. So we actually, in some ways, became more successful spreading what we are into to the rest of the world by kind of becoming part of it.
That brings me to you, Emma Yingling. As a younger person, if during those periods of time in the 80s and so on, there was a little bit of a change in the visualization of hippies, what are you guys doing now? Is your younger generation beginning to open it back up?
I think so. I think same as when we talked about medical marijuana, there are so many people that aren't, they're just not educated about the impact that we have on our environment or what peace within ourselves, within our community, everything can do for you. But I have people my age here in Fayetteville, they have a hog farm on the Buffalo here, and there's been a big movement to try to stop that. They already have thousands of hogs there, but they're trying to stop further operations like that from happening. And so many people my age have become involved with that. They've driven all the way there for meetings, to protest. So I certainly think it's present. Not as present as I would like, but everything needs work.
So are you saying that activism is becoming more a part of the younger generation, similar to what was happening in maybe the 60s and 70s?
I think so, yes.
Let me change the direction of the discussion just a little bit and talk about one of the things that I think is important in when you think about the hippies, and that is music. Tom Cloud, talk to me about the music of your time frame that was associated with being a hippie.
Appeared very groundbreaking to us. It was a rather renaissance in music that went from in kind of insipid little love songs to songs that had social statements or spiritual direction or presented cutting-edge ideas to the people. And certainly the Beatles are one of the better-known groups that brought us just a whole new way to think. And I would say certainly the Grateful Dead from then until now has been a huge influence through their music and through the people that gather to attend concerts or participate in that type of music. It has certainly certainly kept the counterculture present and active through the concerts and gatherings and various events like that about the country.
Well, Rob Savoia, same question. The music that you've seen across time with the generations, what are some of the groups or some of the things about the music that is defining those people who call themselves hippies?
Well, so I'll be honest. From the mid-70s on, I was a total raging deadhead. I mean, I've probably seen the Dead play 400 times. But, you know, a lot of it was the music was sort of a good reason for us to get together. And often, like Tom was saying, the music had real meaning to us. It often, sometimes even motivated us to go do good things because, you know, the words really got to us. And, of course, we'd go to these music festivals and concerts and meet lots of other kind of like-minded people. And it was even more motivation to do the right thing, kind of like that. I mean, music has had a huge impact on my life. I mean, to this very day, I work music festivals. I mean, it's a great collection of people and events, and we enjoy the music together, and it kind of binds us all. It's pretty fascinating. I mean, you can be at a Rainbow Gathering, and if you're trying to find a song that like 10 people that have never played together know, it's going to be something, you know, like a Grateful Dead song. That's the stuff that everybody knows, you know, Neil Young, you know, those kinds of things. It's pretty fascinating.
Well, Emma Yingling, your perspective as a young person, do you guys still adapt the same types of music, the same groups, or what's happening now?
People my age who would consider themselves a hippie still listen to bands like that, the Grateful Dead, Bob Dylan. I would think of Joan Baez, too, because she did a lot of work, and she and Bob Dylan, I think, toured together and actively protested the war. So people my age are still listening to that, and there's upcoming bands that are more coming out with songs today, but I don't find the same feeling, the same words, lyrics, the same kind of music that hits me deep inside my soul as music from the 70s, 80s. I associate that more with being a hippie or that kind of music.
Well, I think that's kind of an important statement there, Emma, and I want the others to expand on that too. What is it about the lyrics or the music that won't allow or maybe overpowers new songs coming in? Is there something about type of music that was then that is really stronger than what's out now?
I think the groups aren't there in as much depth as they were back then. I mean, and that was the beginning of that movement, so we're obviously going to associate it with that kind of music. But I also just feel a power in that genre, in that time period, that I don't feel is present right now. It's hard to explain it beyond that.
Well, Rob Savoia, can you explain it all about the power that's in that music?
Well, yeah, you know, as I said, I to this very day, I actually run a couple of music festivals. The music seems to have to be a lot more commercial these days and a lot less trying to actually reach to people, whether they're reaching to their heart, whether to their mind and stuff like that. And, you know, a lot of the music that you're talking about was really different from the stuff that came before. And I think that was one of our unifying things, is that we actually really kind of liked all this music together. But I think a lot of the times the music often, bizarrely, motivated us to do things. We were enjoying the music. They would say things that we would agree with, and we were in a group of people that we agreed with, and I think a lot of times, it really was a binding thing. It kind of pulled a lot of us all together.
Well, strangely enough, where Tom Cloud is up there in Mountain View, Arkansas, is not known necessarily, from what I can gather, Tom, as hippie type of music. You're in a country kind of place, aren't you?
We're in Defton Bluegrass, where the town bills itself as the folk music capital of the world.
And tell me how that fits into with the group of people that come to your store all the time.
Well, you know, as always, the mainstream is the surface, and then there's a lot of bands that are bringing other kinds of music. In a nearby town called Leslie, we have a blues club that's opened up to great reception, and they just recently had a blues festival in Leslie. And we have bands here in town that are their own music that is definitely rock and roll as opposed to the folk music.
I'm kind of in a bluegrass area, too, to be honest.
So that fits with the philosophy of being a hippie?
I think so. I mean, a lot of festivals, I think that, you know, folk music and bluegrass music, a lot of the bands that we were just talking about actually got really into folk music.
Right.
And acoustic music. I mean, the Grateful Dead started as a folk music bluegrass jug band and stuff like that. You know, I know that where I live, you know, my nearby town has got a lot of bands, Leftover Salmon, Runaway Truck Ramp, New Elephant Revival and stuff like that. And they all think of themselves as deadheads, but they like to play bluegrass.
And Bob Dylan and Joan Baez came out of, and Joni Mitchell all came out of folk roots. And and it continues now with String Cheese Incident, and yep. Even like Ben Harper and some of the popular people today are carrying forward that tradition and bringing new stuff to it.
Well, let me change the directions again here. Anytime you talk about hippies, I guess you have to talk a little bit about geography. And there's a couple of places that come to mind in those early times. Woodstock back in 1969 and Haight-Ashbury in California, Berkeley in California in 67 to 69, that time frame. Is there a place now that you would say has the same kind of connection to being a hippie? Emma Yingling, is there a place for hippies these days?
For me personally, not that comes to mind. The people that I know in my generation, probably, we seem to, and I feel this too, I seem to want to actually hide away and kind of get off in the middle of nowhere and have my place there and still try to be active in teaching my population about being a hippie or what it is to care about the environment you're living in. But the thing that comes to mind for me, I know it's not the same place every year, but Rainbow Gathering. I mean,
yep. I'd also say Asheville, North Carolina. I think it yep. might be on the downhill swing from its peak, but it was a hippie mecca even 5 years ago. Everybody was heading out there because it was a cool place to live and like-minded people.
Yeah, I think there's little enclaves. I hate to say, I think of my little rural mountain town. So we're about 20 miles west of Boulder, Colorado, up in the mountains. And there's lots of old self-identified, quote, hippies that live in our area, and it's like a vortex. And younger hippies come to be with the mid-aged hippies and the older hippies, and it's like really amazing. But at the same point is we have a town with lots of nonprofits, huge amounts of community work, a lot of really amazing things happen, and it's kind of, I'll be honest, it's one of the reasons I live where I do. It's a rural area, so I can have my peace and quiet. But
there
when I need a little bit of culture, I drive the 6 miles to town, and it's the kind of culture that I really get into. Lots of free music, I said, free food boxes, people really looking out for each other. And I'm glad I live near a hippie town that still thinks of itself as a hippie town. We had the first dispensaries in Colorado, you know, things like that. We have the first recreational marijuana coffee shop opening in a couple weeks.
Emma Yingling, you're in Fayetteville. Could you say it is sort of a hippie town or not?
Compared to others, yes. I'm not sure if I would give it that label.
I would say that almost all university towns tend to have a hippie element. But,
yep.
I wouldn't call the town.
No,
yeah.
I wouldn't say the town itself is, but it has a strong presence of hippie. Columbia, Missouri is a town that has a huge alternative community that is able to interact with the more mainstream community and produce great Earth Days and bring, you know, cutting-edge things to the people. It certainly isn't everywhere.
I do want to bring in one of the aspects about it that comes from my memory anyway. The time frame where during the 60s was also the time frame of the Vietnam War. My question to all three of you guys, as you think about it, did the Vietnam War sort of hijack and derail the hippie political preferences of that time, or did the hippies just catch the blame for all that happened there?
I think the resistance to the war was a hugely unifying part of it. I think that the courage to speak out against it, out of the counterculture's resistance to following the mainstream mindlessly and unquestioningly and serving the what we call the machine, they began to resist it on all levels, and certainly the war was one of the hugest ones. And when the war seemed to be ended, that really marked, in my opinion, the end of the groundswell of the hippie movement, and to sort of be diluted into the job market and into the sort of people Rob described that wanted to bridge both worlds, have a job and raise a family, but still not buy into a predetermined worldview that caused you to shut off your mind and your heart and follow somebody else's directive, who you should be.
Well, Rob Savoye, what about your thoughts on the Vietnam War and its impact on hippies?
Well, and I think I agree with Tom. I mean, if you are a visible anti-war protester, you often got a lot of harassment. It was sometimes a hard thing to be out there protesting for peace. And I think it was a very much a unifying thing because of the harassment factor that the other people that you were protesting with were also there consciously because they wanted to try and make an impact in spite of the potential bad ramifications and stuff was a definite unifying thing. And then, yeah, when the war basically ended, I mean, I was psyched. You know, I was not looking forward to going to Vietnam myself. Yeah, I think it took a lot of one of the big unifying things out of what made people get together, so to speak. At the same point as I see the shift, you know, there's a lot of occasionally harshness at that time against the actual soldiers themselves, most of whom were drafted and had very little conscious joint in being sent over to Vietnam and back. And I think you see it now where there's a lot of anti-war protesting is against the military and the government's policies, not against the individual soldiers. And I think that some of that is a impact of that time. We're doing it differently. The soldiers aren't responsible for what they're made to do. The government that does it.
In both cases, we find a great number of the soldiers come back home and embrace the counterculture.
Well, rainbow gatherings were started by people that had gotten back from Vietnam and actually strongly to their core really felt that need to focus on peace. So that's kind of a real big part of the rainbow culture, I think, was a lot of the Vietnam-era stuff.
Well, Emma Yingling, let me ask you about the, of course, you're way too young to have any connection to the to the Vietnam War, but that connection that these guys have been talking about to their time frame and how important it was to their development in the hippie thought processes, what do young people, how do they relate to the impact the Vietnam War had on being a hippie? Is it good or bad?
I think good. It brought people together, like they already said, that were like-minded, that wanted to fight for something rather than following the mainstream. We have people like that today because of that movement.
How does the younger generation look in a similar or dissimilar way at war?
Like he just said, too, it's a different situation now because you're not drafted. It's a conscious choice. Although many of the people I grew up with join the army because they didn't have any money, and that was a way to go to school or to live, basically, to have a home for a few years. So that's still a bit of a frustrating part to do with it, but it's just a different aspect of war now. I hate the connotation that goes with hippies that are for peace or anti-war, but we still care for the soldiers and support our soldiers. I do see a lot of dissonance between those two things where people just associate hippies with being anti-war, being against our soldiers. We still support our troops.
Are younger people being chastised for being for the soldiers? Is that something that young people today don't do?
I've never personally experienced that, honestly.
It was kind of bad at sometimes back then, yeah.
Yeah, it was.
The mindset that these people did not have to follow orders and did not have to participate in the slaughter of civilians, and therefore certain parts of the counterculture.
It was a bad time to be a soldier.
It was a bad time to be everybody, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I want to ask one other question that if you're going to have a discussion about hippies, I know one of the other words that comes back almost all the time early on in the discussion is drugs. So let me just ask it to all three of you guys, fair or unfair, the association of drugs with being a hippie. Tom Cloud?
Oh, well, not every hippie experiments with drugs. I would say that it's definitely fair. I think that part of the hippie culture was the exploration of consciousness, that soul. And we discovered that certain substances would give us a different feeling, a different worldview, sometimes reveal things about ourselves or about how the world works. And many of us felt we were doing a spiritual thing to change our consciousness and see what that process taught us. And many people found very positive results in that. Not everybody, but many changed their lives entirely because of what they experienced in LSD trips or being part of the marijuana culture. Things kind of got hinky when we got into the more unnatural substances, the methamphetamines and cocaines and things. That definitely had a negative impact, and we still carry that impact. People see us as sometimes as meth heads or crackheads or what are the various things. I think for many of us it was very positive, and for a few it was a negative thing. But I do think that the public does largely carry that view. A long-haired person, they assume, is a person that is in favor of changing their consciousness through chemical means, and sometimes that's true and sometimes it isn't.
Well, Rob Savoye, fair or unfair?
No, I think to a degree that's a definite perception that a lot of society has about, quote, hippies and stuff. And I kind of agree with Tom. A lot of it was trying to reprogram our brains because, you know, as we say in Rainbow Babylon, the sort of mainstream society around us is a pretty powerful influence. And so, as Tom said, the joke of better living through better chemistry was an attempt to reprogram our brains to really change our spiritual, mental direction. It kind of seemed like it worked. at the same point, as I know a lot of us, at least in my groups of friends, have kind of gone past that, even though we could care less what other people want to do. And a lot of us have gotten into things like Tai Chi and yoga and a lot of other similar things that we often find gives us a lot of the same positive aspects.
Well, Emma Yingling, fair or unfair about the drug portion of it?
I would say fair. But as he already said, I mean, when you get into the more chemical or man-made drugs, then it, to me, it gets to be unfair, but that was a certain population that involved themselves with that, so that would have also associated with being a hippie.
I just find that the, quote, hippie ideals in a lot of ways have actually become part of mainstream society, and I think of definitely we have achieved a lot of our silly goals at one point in time. People used to make fun of us, and now we're kind of together with people. So, you know, as I said, recycling is common, composting, you know, a lot of different things, green energy and stuff like that. So I think we've had a real impact on the world, and I think hopefully we continue through the younger generations to continue having that long-term impact.
You know, the other word that goes with peace is love, and I think a great many of us embrace the love concept that our world is not a place for us to conquer or other people are not our competitors, but that if we approach our entire life through the goal and the view of love, it totally transforms everything that we do. It makes competition into cooperation. It makes an enemy into someone that you can dialogue with and eventually see as just like yourself. I think love is a huge aspect of the hippie movement and a huge thing that the world needs to embrace to pull us out of the downward spiral that we're in.
I guess one of the things some people would talk about is communal living. Is communal living something that still is a part of being a hippie? I know it was pretty much, I guess, Tom, in your time frame there. Is it still?
What I think that most people found was it's very hard for a large group of people to live in the same space. And I think communal living has evolved more into land trusts and that sort of thing, where you have your own space and you do your own thing, but you're part under an umbrella of a larger thing, rather like the farm in Tennessee operates that way.
I think we've shifted to community instead of commune.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Emma, does communal living fit into young people's thinking at all?
Not particularly. I know a couple of my friends who would say that they lived in a commune outside of Fayetteville. I'm not sure that I would label it that, but I think they're right. The word community is more true than commune.
One last question for all three of you to kind of think a little bit about here and give me your response to. Our particular program, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, obviously is a generational program. And when I think about the generations, they usually last about 80 years or so, and then they move on. And we're losing a lot of the World War II people now. The GI generation is winding down on us. Pretty soon, the boomers will be in that much senior year. We'll move on.
We are
moving on, yes. And I want to ask you guys to kind of project yourselves maybe two or three generations forward when Emma is actually in the older generation, and there's a couple of younger generations then ahead of her. What do you guys see hippies 50, 80 years from now? Tom?
Well, I constantly have young people from, you know, 9 years old on up to Emma's age say they wish they had lived in the 60s and they were hippies. And my constant answer is this time needs hippies, and it's very good that they're hippies in this time. And I think that this will be carried forward and expanded on and improved upon as the newer generations grasp the idea of community and love and peace and respect and alternative life as opposed to life that you're told that you're supposed to follow. I have a great hope for this spiritual movement to continue forward for perhaps hundreds of years. Not always be called hippie, but the feeling, the concepts are all there, and they're a very important part of society, in my opinion.
Well, Rob Savoyer, especially dealing with the Rainbow Gatherings, as you look forward several generations, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think Tom's kind of right. I think the label is sort of going away, but a lot of the beliefs and stuff have not gone away. I mean, the last couple of years at Rainbow Gatherings, there's been a lot of, as we call them, kitchens, you know, a couple dozen people get together and decide to feed everybody around. And some of these kitchens are a bunch of, you know, 20-something kids, and it's really beautiful. It's amazing. They're doing the same thing we were all trying to do 35 and 40 years ago, and I don't think it's dying. But they don't think of themselves always as hippies. They're there because they want to do service lifestyles. They want to help people. They want to, as Tom was saying, practice loving people and stuff. And I don't think a lot of that's going to go away. Just the label probably will. But the more and more we infiltrate our beliefs in the mainstream society, we don't need the label anymore.
Well, Emma, that's an interesting point there. Emma, how do you see your senior years as you look across the horizon then?
I see it growing, ever growing. I do think that that name is going to fall away, and I like how both of you just worded that, because there are people my age who are involved in service activities or simply have a wide spiritual view on the world that I wouldn't say are hippies, and they would not refer to themselves as a hippie, but their mindset and the way that they think and what they want for the world and the amount of love that they have, it's growing from person to person. I don't think the word hippie will be used for that, for those types of people, though.
Well, we've had a really great discussion here about hippies here today. I want to thank my three guests for being with me here. Tom Cloud, speaking to us from Mountain View, Arkansas, up there. He and his wife run the For Mother Earth store. And Tom, coming up in your area there, do you have any festivals coming up that you'll be seeing a lot of people who might be some hippies coming up there?
Well, we just had a blues festival in a town called Leslie, about 30 miles away. I don't know of anything in our immediate area. I know that over toward Fayetteville and in between us and Fayetteville, there are things like Mulberry Mountain and different gatherings that the counterculture certainly celebrate and fully support.
Well, if you happen to be listening to the program today and you're planning a trip to Mountain View this summer, stop into Tom's store and tell him you heard him here on the radio today. I'm sure he'll be glad to know he...
I thought to see. Yeah.
And then speaking from the middle generation along with the older generation, here has been Rob Savoyer. He's the self-appointed maintainer of the unofficial Rainbow Family website. And Rob, I'm so glad you could join us here today. And tell our folks a little bit about what's coming up for the Rainbow Gathering this year.
Basically, we're going to be someplace in Montana. Directions will be out in about 2 to 3 weeks. We're looking forward to another good gathering. I mean, after, I hate to say, 15 years of government harassment and trying to shut us down, they gave up. And so I'm encouraging people to come and be in our community for that time that we're there.
And do you guys have a website?
Welcomehome.org.
Okay. And then our younger generation guest today has been Emma Yingling, and she's up in Fayetteville. She's from Winslow, though, and she is on the steering committee and serves as the secretary for the medical marijuana campaign in Arkansas, the Arkansans for Compassionate Care. And Emma, I'm glad you came with us here today.
Well, thanks for having me. I always enjoy it.
Again, folks, thanks for listening to the program today. You can catch, as I mentioned earlier, the longer version of our program on the podcast at KUAR.org. It's on the right-hand side of the programs page. Again, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of UALR Public Radio and comes to you from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, Arkansas.